The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce Magazine. My first article to share with you today is titled Golden Age in Harlem, and this was written by Natalie Wysong. The 1920s were in swing as writers, artists, and musicians transformed the streets of New York City's Harlem neighborhood with a powerful mix of artistic, social, and political work. The cultural movement began with the Great Migration of African Americans from the rural South toward northern industrial hubs and their promise of jobs. In urban centers, particularly Harlem, creativity challenged prejudice, shaped an identity, and uplifted a new generation. Jazz was the sound of the Harlem Renaissance, and Duke Ellington was a familiar figure at its center. But poets and painters, Langston Hughes, Jacob Lawrence, caught its rhythms too. The Harlem movement faded like so much in the United States with the Great Depression, but it marked a turning point for black culture. And I'll share with you some of the many artists whose work still inspire. Zorl Neale Hurston. Black-owned publications in New York catered to writers who were finally free to express themselves. They responded with a richness of poetry, essays, and fiction about African-American life. Zora Neale Hurston was a native of the rural South, a folklorist and anthropologist. Her novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God, was about folks she knew. Overlooked for many years, Hurston's writing regained attention in the 1970s thanks to Alice Walker. Hurston followed in the footsteps of writers such as W.E.B., Du Bois, and Jesse Redman Fawcett. Du Bois was a lifelong activist for equal treatment of blacks and founded the monthly magazine The Crisis in 1910. Fawcett, the magazine's editor, identified promising writers and wrote novels dealing with race, class, and identity. Langston Hughes. If the literary movement had a center, it was Langston Hughes, who recorded key first-person accounts about the era. His poetry drew from black oral traditions and the rhythms of blues and jazz. In a poem he wrote just after graduating high school, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, Hughes traced African roots from the Mississippi River back to the Nile and the Euphrates. Hughes was shaped by time spent abroad, and his insistence on expressing a strong sense of identity affected others in the movement, such as Lorraine Hansberry. Her Broadway play about the trauma of racism borrowed a line from Hughes' poem Harlem. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Jacob Lawrence. Against the colorful backdrop of black-run studios, clubs, and churches, Jacob Lawrence came of age, poised to further the intellectual and creative activity of the era. As a teen, he latched onto art as a means of expression, encouraged by sculptor Augusta Savage. He worked with and later married painter Gwendolyn Knight, another of Savage's students. His subject matter included meticulous research and his series of paintings that depict the lives of famous historical figures such as Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass are among his most widely known. Augusta Savage. Augusta Savage was larger than life, a champion to black artists who got a start in her Harlem studio. Savage was drawn to sculpture as a child, using the distinctive red clay soil of her native Florida to mold figures. After studying abroad on a fellowship, she ran a school out of her studio, offering free art education. Much of her work did not survive. A commission piece for the 1939 New York World's Fair, a 16-foot sculpture with 12 singing figures, was destroyed after the fair. Savage worked mostly in plaster rather than the conventional and expensive bronze. One existing sculpture in the Smithsonian's collection is Gaiman, a bust of a young boy which is done in plaster and painted to look like bronze. Duke Ellington. The Jazz Age permeated literature, visual art, theater, and dance, and no one better represented Harlem's golden era of creativity than composer and musician Edward Duke Ellington. Ellington infused his music with his love of ragtime and his diverse catalog of compositions, written to suit the styles of the performers at the Cotton Club, was challenging and complex. No two performances were alike. Reaching audiences through live shows and radio broadcast, Ellington elevated jazz, the American original, to an aesthetic. Bessie Smith. Bessie Smith on stage was powerful and majestic, and her recording sold millions of copies. Orphaned, Smith was raised by her sister and sang for money as a child. The Empress of the Blues sang about the kinds of trouble that most listeners knew well. Even when she was the highest-paid black performer of the day, her laments felt personal. She was criticized for being rough and bawdy, but songs like "Tain't Nobody's Business If I Do" seemed to represent her feelings about others' opinions. In a world where the power was held by others, Smith defied prejudice and segregation to make listeners understand that her life mattered too. Our next article is from the Last Laugh section, and it's titled Big Fish in a Small Pond, Little Brother Fell for It, Hook, Line, and Sinker, and this was submitted by Bonnie Borema of Naples, Florida. This is a different kind of fish story, one that's really about the relationship between two brothers. The younger one, Butch, is easygoing and dedicated to whatever he does. Kenny, who's my husband, is 7 years older and has always been a joker. He loves to play tricks, especially on his little brother. For his 5th birthday, Butch got an aquarium. It was filled with aquarium ornaments and had a lot of room for several small goldfish to swim. Every day after school, like clockwork, Butch fed the little guys. He loved those fish. This routine went on for some time until Kenny had the bright idea of playing a prank on his little brother. One day, Kenny bought a large goldfish, about 6 inches, and used Butch's fish net to move all the little goldfish from the aquarium into a smaller bowl. He left the one big fish in the aquarium. It was a good thing Butch was taking a particularly long time returning from school that day. Then Kenny hid in his brother's closet and waited. The first thing Kenny heard after his brother got home was Butch yelling, "Mom, look!" Their mom came in and was as flabbergasted as Butch at the surprise in the aquarium. Kenny listened to Butch trying to account for the mystery. "Maybe I mixed the fish food and I discovered something. I could be rich." Mom wondered where the other fish were, and Butch surmised that the big goldfish had eaten the little ones. Finally, Kenny couldn't contain himself, and he came out of the closet laughing so hard tears were falling. The jig was up. As usual, Kenny got in trouble, but he was used to that. Our next article is from Motoring Memories, and it's titled Cruisin' in the Ford. Parents put the brakes on borrowing the family car, and this is submitted by James Farkas of Northfield, Michigan. One Sunday, the girl I was dating, her name escapes me, invited me to her house in Lincoln Park, Michigan. At 17, I had my temporary license and had already suffered the humiliation of Dad driving us to a school dance. Now he was asleep in front of the TV, and the car keys were in their usual spot in the kitchen. As I drove from Allen Park to her house, I put on the latest Detroit doo-wop so I'd look cool as I drove up. We cruised down Fort Street and went to the drive-in for a malt and skinny fries before I got nervous. At home, I faced the firing squad. My Lincoln Park sweetie didn't wait for me while I was grounded for 4 weeks, and she moved on to date someone who had a car. I'd saved $500, and Mom thought it was time Dad used his influence as a Ford employee to get me the best deal on a used car. That shopping day was one of the most important of my young life. We found a 1951 powder blue Ford Custom with baby moon hubcaps and bubble skirts. It even had air conditioning and a radio. After much dialogue, Dad and the salesman agreed on $800, with Dad putting in the extra for me. 2 weeks later, it was my turn to drive my friends on a Friday night. Joe, Norm, and I headed for Michigan Avenue in Dearborn, which was jammed with custom hot rods. With windows down and moving at a crawl, we tried our best to get the attention of the cute girls at the drive-ins. I wasn't watching the traffic in front of me, and with a loud thud, I hit the rear of a black 1950 Ford. There was no damage to the older couple's car, but my front end was smashed. They felt sorry for me, and luckily, the only expense was replacing my custom Pontiac grill. Dad thought it was a lesson learned, and all Mom could do was laugh. From then on, I kept my eyes on the road, no matter how cute the girls were. The next article I have for you is titled, Name That Car. Texas Native Sticks Close to Home. Needing something to do when I retired in 1999, I was inspired by a friend's hobby, restoring classic cars. In 2008, I finally found the right project. The car was still with its original owner and had 74,000 miles on it. Parked in an open garage for 34 years, it was covered in a layer of dust and had 4 flat tires, a dented rear door, and a cracked side window. On the plus side, Blue, as I called the car, had only a little surface rust. It had power seats, windows, brakes, and steering, along with a power antenna and a Wonder Bar radio. Under the hood was a big 401 cubic inch V8 and automatic transmission. By mid-2009, Blue was back in showroom condition. I've entered it in many parades and car shows and brought home numerous trophies and awards. I learned that the car was built in Arlington, Texas, and sold new from a dealership near there. It eventually was retired to the garage where I found it near Floresville. You could consider it a Texas native. Blue's model year is the same year I graduated from high school. It was the last year of the big fins. Car buffs call this four-door hardtop style a flat top, just like the hairstyle I wore in high school. Now, here are some other clues to help you identify what car this is. The brand's founder, a Scot, invented a method for enameling cast iron bathtubs. The Wildcat engine was labeled a 445 for its peak torque. And this was the first year the model, the brand's top of the line, was offered. The model and a Lockheed plane share a name with a Texas heiress. A numerical suffix refers to the car's length in inches. Now, do you know what kind of car this is? It is a 1959 Buick Electra 225. Our next article is from Back in Time, and it is titled, Many Friendly Hands Make Light Work. Accident at harvest time brought farm neighbors together, and this is submitted by Lloyd Richards of Mooresville, North Carolina. Helping neighbors was something everyone did when I was growing up on a farm near Meriden, Kansas in the 40s and 50s. Near the end of one wheat season, our neighbor Raymond had a terrible accident. My dad, Lowell, and I kept an eye on his crop, and one day we decided it was ready and started up our 1941 Farmall H tractor and pull-type combine, and Alice Chalmers All-Crop 66. We knew that when the neighbors saw us harvesting Raymond's field, they would come and help if they could. Sure enough, shortly after we started cutting, people began to show up with their equipment. More combines, balers, trucks, and tractors with plows and disc. The wheat field was about 25 acres, pretty big for eastern Kansas at that time. The combines were small. Ours cut a 5.5-foot swath. The ones today can cut a swath 60 feet wide. A combine that big couldn't even have turned around in the field. By mid-afternoon, the farmers' wives, mothers, and other family members began to arrive, bringing fried chicken, pies, and more for the army of workers. At the end of the day, Raymond's wheat had been harvested and taken to the elevator. The straw was cut, baled, and stored, and the field was plowed and reworked. Raymond was able to come out of the house and watch all the activity from his yard. He knew that everyone had their own farms to take care of and what it meant that his neighbors had spent their day helping. Farmers like to brag a little about how much better their tractors are than someone else's. It's all in fun. But most of the talk that day was about how fast Raymond's crop went from a field of wheat to one ready for the next crop. Several years ago, I moved to an over 55 community where we still try to help one another. The appreciation for neighbors helping neighbors has stayed with me my entire life. And my next article is titled, Ray Charles Strikes Gold. Playing a dance hall in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in December of 1958, Ray Charles and his 7-piece band ran through their entire repertoire and then realized they had some time to kill. Knowing the band had to finish the 4-hour set to get paid, Charles dug deep and came up with a groovable beat and simple lyrics, mostly oohs and ahs, that lit up the crowd. "There was nothing left that I could think of," Charles recalled in Brother Ray, Ray Charles' own story. "So I finally said to the band and the Raylettes, 'Listen, I'm going to fool around and y'all just follow me.'" A blues-based boogie-woogie riff on his electric keyboard set the stage. Then Charles began tossing out short lyric lines, which he encouraged the backup singers to repeat in a church-style call and response. The dance crowd went wild. And Ray later remembered, "When I got through, folks came up and asked me where they could buy the record. 'Ain't no record,' I said, 'just something I made up to kill a little time.'" Recorded a few months later in New York City, the song was released in June 1959. "What'd I Say?" blended rhythm and blues, gospel and jazz in the relatively new style of soul. That summer, Charles's disc reached number 1 on the R&B charts and crossed over to number 6 on the pop list, bringing him a new audience. White teens who were enthralled by a sound that was boldly different, irresistibly sexy, and extremely danceable. Charles already had a number of hit singles, but the serendipitous song he created to run out the clock became his first official gold record. And today, it is regarded as one of the best of the early rock era. From the Spotlight section, I have an article about Rod Serling. Rod Serling started writing TV scripts in his 20s, winning Emmys in 1956, 57, and 58, but often battled program censors and sponsors who found his work too controversial. In 1959, Serling cannily turned to science fiction. In the creepy fifth dimension of The Twilight Zone, which debuted that October, social commentary breezed past censors while still delivering an emotional wallop. Serling would win 3 more Emmys, 2 for Twilight Zone scripts, and was inducted into the Television Academy Hall of Fame in 1985. He earned a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star in World War II. He was injured while serving with the Army in the Philippines. Flashbacks and nightmares haunted him for years afterward. His now famous narration was actually Plan B. Serling framed each episode of The Twilight Zone with a riveting clip delivery, but had wanted actor Richard Egan and no one else to do it. When that didn't work out, Serling said he'd do it himself. He was his own toughest critic. In his last interview on March 4, 1975, Serling was loath to call anything he'd written important and thought that only his teleplays, Requiem for a Heavyweight and their tearing down Tim Riley's bar would stand the test of time. He was a devoted family man. Despite Serling's grueling schedule, daughter Anne says she never felt the 12-hour workday. He wrote her loving notes addressed to Miss Grumple, signed Roddy Rabbit. His voice was as distinctive as his writing. From 1968 to 1974, Serling narrated 28 episodes of The Undersea World of Jacques Cousteau. He's still a sci-fi legend. In 2004, TV Guide rated him number one on its list of 25 greatest sci-fi legends. Everyone else was a fictional character. Star Trek Cruise came in at number two, but the series creator, Serling's friend Gene Roddenberry, didn't make the list. Roddenberry gave the eulogy at Serling's funeral. From the Growing Up section, Randall Schaefer submits an article titled Room and Board for the Winter. December 1952 in Whitewater, Wisconsin was bitterly cold. A curious seven-year-old, I was in suspense when my father arrived home from work with something bundled in his jacket. "Guess what I have," he said. He slowly unwrapped the jacket to reveal a stiff screech owl. He found the frozen bird on the hood of his car when he left work and speculated that it had flown into the windshield. Dad thought it might be alive and wanted to let it warm up. My mother unenthusiastically agreed to let the bird stay overnight, so Dad and I took it to the basement and carefully laid it near our coal furnace. I was the first one into the kitchen the next morning for a bowl of cereal. I looked up from peering into the box for the prize and was face to face with the screech owl. It perched on the sugar bowl as if waiting for its breakfast. I hurried to tell my parents that the owl was alive and sitting at the kitchen table. Mom didn't like that it was in the kitchen and wanted it out of the house. Dad instructed me to open the back door while he shooed the owl toward me. I heard the flapping of wings, but before I could direct its flight outside, the owl spun away from the frigid air coming into the door and zipped past me, down the stairs into the shelter of the warm basement. Perched in the space above the beams, the owl was safely beyond our reach. We tried driving it out with a broom, but it calmly flew to the far side of the basement. Soon, Dad and I were laughing too hard to continue the chase, and we realized there was no way we could evict the owl if it wanted to stay. As Dad left for work and I went to school, Mom wondered how she was supposed to do the laundry, since the washing machine was in the basement. She quickly realized that my two-year-old brother's fascination with the wild bird kept him busy. In turn, the owl tolerated our presence, and Mom resigned herself to having it in the house until Dad could catch it when it became weak from hunger. But that never happened. The coal door, which didn't seal properly, allowed mice into the basement. The owl had been in our basement for just a few days when Dad showed me an owl pellet, the tidy nugget of indigestible parts that an owl regurgitates. Over the winter, we found these regularly, and the owl became so fat, Dad might have easily caught it. But by that time, we liked the natural rodent control, and I enjoyed showing my friends the owl that lived in my basement and explaining its eating habits. Spring came late, and within a few weeks, we found no more owl pellets. Warmer weather meant that mice no longer took shelter in our basement and that the owl had run out of food. We opened the back door and were prepared to harass the bird for as long as it took to get it outside. But the owl knew it was time to leave. With a single wave of the broom, Dad chased it up the stairs, out the door, and into the tall pear tree in our backyard. We observed the owl around the neighborhood for a few more days, and then it was gone. We felt a sense of loss. The owl had given us hours of entertainment in repayment for its rescue. We took comfort knowing it was free and healthy, if a bit overweight. Almost 70 years have passed. I recently asked Mom if she remembers that owl, and she smiled broadly. My brother remembers, too, and since that cold December evening in 1952, I cannot hear the words, "Guess what I have," without remembering my father unwrapping a frozen screech owl. And our next article is from the True Love section, and it's submitted by William Mason from Columbus, Ohio, and it's titled, "Striking It Rich." My mother, Bernice, was living in the mining town of Butte, Montana, with her two children. She'd survived the Great Depression and the turmoil of World War II, but had been put in a new and difficult position when her husband, an alcoholic and gambler, left for California. He supposedly went to build a new life for them, but a few months later, she received a goodbye note from him, along with a set of divorce papers. Her ex-sister-in-law helped her find a small apartment and even paid the first month's rent, but unable to find employment, Bernice was facing eviction. With no idea from where the next meal would come, she considered one last possibility. Butte's economy relied on the mining industry, and she reasoned that the miners' union might have some funds available for women in need. She and the children walked 2 miles to the Miners' Union Hall in the downtown commercial area. The receptionist told her she was not eligible to receive assistance from the union since she wasn't the wife of a miner. As my mother pleaded her case, she could see a man with wavy brown hair, and this man was Union President Bill Mason, and he was listening to her story and deciding whether to intervene. Bill and his family immigrated from Croatia when he was 10. 2 years later, his father abandoned his wife and two children, and Bill dropped out of school and became a miner to support the family. That day, Bill invited Bernice and her kids to lunch, and then he offered to take them out for dinner. It was the beginning of their courtship. They married in 1947. I was born in 1948. And 4 years later, they purchased a new home in a subdivision near Butte. Dad often gave Mom a single rose as a reminder of his love, and he sometimes danced with her at the sink while she washed dishes. Dad died in an auto accident when I was 14. Even though I was young, I knew my parents were deeply in love. And here are some things that were popular in 1959. Dinner Theater. Two students in Washington, D.C. organize a theatrical first. Customers can watch a show from their dining tables. And the word Hump Day. Working stiffs have known this for decades. Wednesday means the week is half over. The rest of the way is all downhill. We've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. And we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And Reminisce is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.